Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We are your hosts, Matt Levine
and Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Thank you everyone for hanging out. Thanks for listening to this episode. Please rate and review Camp Kaiju wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. We definitely love to broaden our network of listeners. And finally, send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com. Vincent, what's going on with our website these days?
Well, Matt, you just dropped a new written review. What was that one about?
That was about The Guardian, a much maligned movie by William Friedkin, rest in peace. That was one of the few that I hadn't seen when he died. And I was like, I should probably catch up with that movie. And it is awesome. It is a great monster movie, very stylish. So check out William Friedkin's The Guardian, not to mention almost all of William Friedkin's movies. Some of them are pretty bad, but overall, he's you know, one of the legends. So yeah, rest in peace, William Friedkin.
That's awesome. Yes, I need to do my homework there for sure. I've never even seen The Exorcist, which we talked about last week. I still haven't seen it a week later, but spooky season is right around the corner. So we do have some things starting to drift towards, drift away from giant monsters and traditional kaiju. Next week, when we could decide this right now, are we going to talk about The Birds or are we going to talk about something else? Maybe we'll just stick with The Birds.
Okay. Yeah. Because the other one that we're talking about soon is of unknown origin, right? We have a couple killer animal movies coming up. So either The Birds or of unknown origin, or maybe some other, you know, killer animal movies. For all of you listeners out there, if you have any suggestions for your favorite killer animal movies for us to talk about, please let us know. Again, you can comment on our Instagram page or email us at campkaiju@gmail.com. And maybe we will talk about them on the show.
Yeah, would love to do that.
What else do we have coming up? I think you have a play coming up. Is that right, Vincent?
I do have a play coming up at the Twin Cities Horror Festival in October. More to come on that. It's about a killer hand. but I related to this podcast more specifically is the Minnesota Web Fest, which is a internet-based web festival. Let me rephrase that. It is a festival that's live in person in Duluth, Minnesota, that's dedicated to honoring web-based media. So there's categories for podcasts. Hey, that's us. There's categories for web series as well. But Camp Kaiju has been officially nominated for this year's MN Web Fest in the category of Best New Concept.
Which is awesome. That's so cool. I was curious, like, that nomination caught me off guard. Did you think that might be coming up, or were you surprised by that as well?
I was surprised by that as well. I submitted our Jaws the Revenge episode back in February and just recently got notice from Minnesota Web Fest. It's in person. I don't know, might be there the first week of October, but maybe not because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, for sure.
Huge thanks to the festival and our supporters for making it possible.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very exciting. I've been meaning to go to Duluth, actually, so maybe that's a perfect motivation to do so.
Hey, there you go. You can represent.
Yeah, perfect. Cool. Well, yeah, so today we're talking about, a movie that was critically reviled when it first came out, but has since been reevaluated as maybe one of the great monster movies of the 1990s, and that is Starship Troopers by Paul Verhoeven. Vincent, what is your history with this movie?
I'm so excited you brought this to the table, Matt. Starship Troopers is a movie I only have the vaguest of memories from being a kid. I mean, it came out in 96, 97?
97, yeah.
Okay, I was 6 years old. I think I saw it on TV or maybe someone rented it. And my whole life, I lived with this memory of someone's head getting shot when he took his helmet off.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, Starship Troopers, I get to watch it again. That moment was happening. And I went, that's it. That's the scene from my memory. The rest of the movie is better than that. But maybe I overhyped it for myself.
Yeah. I think this movie might be, you know, again, we're getting ahead of ourselves as we always do on Camp Kaiju, but I think this movie is kind of overhyped in general. Like, you know, according to some people, like the reappraisal is that it's like a subversive masterpiece and like a great movie tackling like American culture and society and all these things. We'll get into the nitty gritty of this, but I think that's maybe a little bit overstated. So yeah, I know what you mean. I was maybe a little bit let down this time around, because I'll talk about my own history with the movie. I first saw it when it came out in 1997. I was 13 years old. And I, you know, for that age, being a young boy, I loved it. You know, like, it's very gory. There's nudity. Like, for the 13-year-old me was like, this movie is awesome.
Yeah.
I, of course, did not really pick up on, like, any of the satire of fascism and militarism and all the other stuff going on in this movie. I've seen it several times since then. I think this is the fourth time that I've seen this movie. And I'll just say for right now that every time I feel like I should like it more than I actually do.
Hmm.
So that's a sneak preview, I guess, of how I feel. So yeah, but there's a lot to talk about. A very kind of surprisingly complex movie. So
yeah.
Should we dive into the plot synopsis?
Sure. Did you want me to start or do you want to start?
Well, either way is fine. You can start if you'd like.
Okay. Sometime in the 23rd century, the Earth is ruled by military elites that are part of the United Citizen Federation. In this society, citizens can only attain full rights, like the right to vote and even have children, once they complete military service. Meanwhile, the government tries to instill in the public the importance of territorial expansion, which in this futuristic setting is taking place in outer space, and an almighty military. This leads to inevitable conflict with races of insect creatures from the planet Klendatu.
So it's in this setting that high school student Johnny Rico, who comes from a wealthy family, decides to enlist as a foot soldier in the Mobile Infantry Unit, along with his friend Diz, or Dizzy. Johnny's girlfriend Carmen joins pilot school in the hopes of becoming a military officer, while their friend Carl joins military intelligence. Rico impresses his superiors in the military and is made squadron leader, but when one of his soldiers is accidentally killed during a training exercise, that's the scene that Vincent was just referring to, Rico is whipped and he resigns from the army. However, he re-enlists when bugs invade their hometown of Buenos Aires, killing Rico's parents.
The military attacks Klendatu, but the invasion goes terribly with numerous casualties. Rico is badly injured and, after recuperating, joins another special forces unit called the Roughnecks. They respond to a distress call on planet P, but another insect attack takes place and several soldiers are killed. Carmen and her co-pilot Xander, who are now romantically involved after she breaks up with Rico, rescue the survivors.
They reunite with their former friend Carl, now a high-ranking military strategist, who explains that the mission to planet P was a trap, designed to test the capabilities of a brain bug that can strategically direct its insect minions. Carl orders the Roughnecks, now led by Rico, back to Planet P, where a final gruesome showdown with the brain bug ensues. There is quite a bit of brain sucking in that scene, which is as gross as it sounds.
Yeah.
Propaganda ad for the military at the end of the film urges viewers to be like Rico and Carmen, who are now successful soldiers. And the ad promises that, quote, they'll keep fighting and they'll win, end quote.
Yeah. I love the narrative of this movie, like the narrative structure of the movie with the sort of this meta advertising propaganda video that bookends the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. I want to say I did read the novel that this is based on this summer in preparation for this episode. So I'm glad I did that. By Robert A. Heinlein. I'm sure that's in your notes. We can talk about that. I'd love to talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I did try to read the novel. I got three chapters in. It's not my favorite book that I've ever read, that's for sure. And we will talk about it for sure. It's there's a lot to pick apart in it, and I think that that's one of the reasons that Verhoeven wanted to make this movie in the first place, to kind of subvert the themes that are kind of glorified in the original novel.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of Paul Verhoeven, we can start with him. He's the director of this movie. He's Dutch. He actually grew up in the Netherlands during World War II. His family lived in The Hague, which was the German headquarters in the Netherlands during World War II.
Hmm.
He talks about his experiences as a child, seeing dead bodies on the street. You know, the house next to where he grew up was bombed by the Allies. He narrowly avoided death. So the themes of kind of social satire and explicit sex and violence that would recur throughout a lot of his movies, you know, in some ways probably go back to that childhood a little bit. He was a very subversive Hollywood director who made movies like RoboCop, Total Recall, Basic Instinct, and Showgirls. However, before that Hollywood career, he also had a successful stint in his native Netherlands. He made movies like Soldier of Orange, Spetters, and The Fourth Man. And then after Hollow Man in 2000 or 2001, I think that came out, he moved back to Europe and he's made his last several movies there, including Black Book, Elle, and Benedetta. He is a really fascinating director. I guess before I talk more about him, what's your experience with his movies, Vincent?
I saw RoboCop for the first time this summer. I had very low expectations of a movie about a robot cop. And that movie, no pun intended, blew my mind. I loved that movie, which is probably why I had such high expectations for Starship Troopers. Hollow Man I had no idea he directed that until this afternoon, because I know that movie is maligned critically, but it's always been on my radar because it's an Invisible Man movie with Kevin Bacon, Tremors connection.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Now that I know who Paul Verhoeven is, I do want to explore his filmography in depth.
Yeah. Pretty much all of his movies are worth watching. I really want to rewatch Showgirls, which is another movie that was like totally lambasted and ridiculed when it first came out, but it has also undergone kind of like a critical reappraisal. So yeah, his movies are always interesting. I do think there's a sense of like coldness to them, which we'll talk about later, but really fascinating director for sure.
Mm-hmm. The screenplay is by Ed Neumeier, who also also wrote RoboCop. Neumeier and Verhoeven.
I've heard Verhoeven. I think that's like the Dutch pronunciation, but
with whom Verhoeven discussed the original novel by Robert Heinlein in depth. The two of them decided to satirize the ideologies that are overt in the novel, such as militarism and fascism, though some would argue the book doesn't actually support those tenets. I might be one of those people, actually. Neumeier also co-wrote RoboCop and wrote several of the Starship Troopers sequels, even directing the third one, Starship Troopers 3 Marauder. Matt, have you watched these sequels?
No, I haven't. I've heard they're pretty bad, but I have to admit, especially after watching Starship Troopers again, I do kind of want to check them out.
Yeah, it's like Tremors. Like, could these be better than I think they are?
Yeah, I bet, you know, like Starship Troopers is so like complex, and I'm probably going to use the word subversive a lot, but I do feel like that's the best way to describe this movie.
Yeah.
I kind of doubt that the sequels have that same level of sort of like, you know, meat on the bones, like things to pick apart, but I bet they're probably fun. So I'd love to watch them.
Right. Exactly. Same thing with the Tremors. They're just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like this actually might be a good time to ask you. Well, no, we'll save that for later. I was going to ask you about the novel, but we'll wait for later on that.
Okay. Okay.
So Starship Troopers was shot by Jost Vacano, a German cinematographer who worked with Verhoeven on seven films, beginning with the Dutch film Soldier of Orange back in 1977. He shot a lot of other classic movies, or at least some other classic movies as well, such as The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum and Das Boot. A fairly well-known cinematographer.
The visual effects are by Phil Tippett, animator and effects designer on Star Wars, Piranha, Dragon Slayer, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Willow, and many other films. Although his career started as a stop-motion animator, his work on Jurassic Park, which was originally supposed to heavily feature his creature effects until Spielberg decided to use mostly CG, forced Tippett to adapt to a new era of effects, offering an ideal fusion of stop motion and CGI. Whatever I have to say about this film that didn't work for me, I think the special effects, practical and computer, really work for me in this movie.
Yeah, I think it looks really good. You know, Tippett is like a pretty major name in like the history of special effects. Maybe not at the level of Willis O'Brien, who we talked about with the King Kong episode. But, you know, Vincent just read off many of the titles that he worked on. And yeah, he definitely heavily influenced special effects in modern movies. So yeah, big name for sure. As far as the cast in this movie, it's a lot of actors who were kind of known at the time for coming from soap operas like Melrose Place and Beverly Hills 90210. Verhoeven has talked about how that was basically intentional. He sort of did not want great actors for this movie. He wanted, you know, actors that seemed kind of vapid and pretty, but not very intelligent, which, you know, is mean, but
and young. Like he wanted to cast actors in their early 20s as opposed to their late 20s or even early 30s.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So we have actors like Casper Van Dien, Dina Meyer, Denise Richards. This was an early movie for all three of them, who would go on to do other things, of course, later in their careers. Neil Patrick Harris is in this movie as well. He was predominantly known as Doogie Howser when this movie came out. So this was his attempt to kind of break away from that typecasting a little bit. And then we have kind of a handful of like gruff macho character actors playing some of the military guys in this movie, including Jake Busey, Clancy Brown, Seth Gilliam, Patrick Muldoon, although Muldoon is maybe a little bit more of the soap opera set there. And finally, Michael Ironside as Gene Ratchak. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Ratchak.
Ratchak, okay.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the most gruff and no-nonsense military soldier in the movie. Interesting cast.
You know, Verhoeven is that kind of director who is incredibly precise about everything he does, including the casting. He's like, I want young actors, which will probably mean they don't have a ton of experience, but they need to look young. We could talk about the casting. The casting's also interesting because he wanted to cast pretty people, but also it seems like people maybe reminiscent of maybe fascist Germany in the 1930s and 40s. Like, they're very blonde, they're very square jawed, they're very quote unquote perfect.
Yeah, he's actually said that in interviews. He wanted to cast people that might have been in Triumph of the Will, which is a very kind of notorious Nazi propaganda movie by Leni Riefenstahl from the late 30s. So yeah, that is definitely an intentional connection. He wanted that sort of Aryan blonde hair, blue-eyed look.
Interesting.
Yeah, so getting into the production backstory of the film, it was in kind of development hell for quite a long time after the success of RoboCop, which I think was from 1987, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Late 80s for sure. The producer, John Davison, wanted to bring the team back together right away, you know, since that RoboCop was very successful. Neumeier happened to be working on a script at the time called Bug Hunt at Outpost 7, which is a great name. And he called it a big, silly, jingoistic, xenophobic, let's go out and kill the enemy movie. And it was actually Davison who was like, oh, this sounds a lot like Starship Troopers. And TriStar executives, the company that funded RoboCop, didn't really have a lot of interest in the project until the Starship Troopers name was kind of attached to it. So that was the point at which Neumeier was like, all right, I'll scrap the script that I was working on and we'll just make this a Starship Troopers adaptation instead. But TriStar Pictures was very much in disarray at the time. A lot of producers were being fired and replaced constantly. There was a producer, Mike Medavoy, who had worked on RoboCop, who greenlit Starship Troopers, was very excited about it. But then he was fired by TriStar, and that's why this movie kind of just languished for several years in the early 1990s. Finally, in 1994, Verhoeven and Tippett teamed up. They wanted to shoot some test footage that they could show to the TriStar executives to convince them to finally, you know, push this project into pre-production. And around the same time, Touchstone Pictures, which is owned by Disney, or at least was at the time, came on as a co-production company. So that's when finally in 1994, the movie got off the ground a little bit. I feel like now might be a good time to ask you about the novel. So the main, you know, I read the first couple chapters, which I did not like very much. But, you know, it's the main thing that I think people talk about with the novel is that it's very fascist, very militaristic. But you said before that you don't totally agree with that. Is that correct?
So the novel is very different in tone and approach. The novel is much more introspective about those themes. We follow Johnny Rico. He's a foot soldier in the mobile infantry. And it's all from his point of view. And yeah, it's not as action-packed as the movie, certainly. It took me a little bit to get into it, but ultimately I did. And it takes place in a world that we would label fascist. So I'm not saying it's not, but I don't think it advocates those themes. I think it's just an author who set his story in that world, which is what I also feel about the movie itself. But at least with the book, I didn't find it offensive. I didn't find it like, it's just here's one soldier's story in a war that I was like, yeah, I mean, I've read this a million times. If that makes it fascist, then, well, that's just war, I guess. But war media, you know what I mean? But yeah. But no, it does take place and it does have some great, more philosophical points to make about control over the state, the state's control over bodies, and what does it mean to be a free human being, and what are rights tied to?
Yeah, I haven't read as much of the book as you, obviously, but even in the first couple chapters, like some of the dialogue, especially in like, you know, in the classroom where they talk about moral philosophy and stuff like that, like some of the dialogue is so over the top. It's like, this couldn't be meant sincerely, could it? Like, clearly it seems like a thematic point or whatever, you know?
Right. So I always think about, have you read All Quiet on the Western Front?
I have not, sadly.
So there's a teacher character in that book who is very militaristic and nationalistic, and that's World War One. But the teacher in All Quiet is telling his students to go fight for the motherland. Hmm. And then, of course, you follow the main character and you realize war is hell. Rico in the book doesn't go on that same journey. He ultimately is proud of the work he does in the military. So there's a key difference there in attitude towards the military. There's a ton of things to talk about politically and philosophically with this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I did read that the book, you know, it's kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's like devoted to like military officers who have like trained soldiers in the past. And I also read that it was like kind of a reaction to the United States suspending its nuclear development efforts, like the very, very much like kind of a response to that, and how Heinlein thought that the military should be strengthening its kind of, you know, weaponry instead of like backing off of it a little bit. So I do, just from like indirectly reading about that a little bit, I do sort of understand the accusations that the book is like very militaristic. But you know, I haven't read all of it, and we'll definitely take your word on that. So
no, I've read all that too. I think this is just like a great piece to discuss, because this is just me speaking. I don't think to be pro-military means you're pro-fascist. I think I personally, whatever my, you know, I'm a pretty liberal guy, but I do really respect the, I do not respect the military industrial complex. Like, that's bullshit.
Indeed.
You know, if a student of mine, for instance, and I've had students enlist in the Army or the Marines, I'm not going to knock them for that. I'm like, yeah, that's a great career. You'll retire younger than you would otherwise. All these benefits, just like human to human, I'd be like, of course I support you. But yeah. Then you get in the bigger picture and it's like, that's a little messier.
Right. That's kind of how I feel too. And I think, like, you know, again, we'll talk about this later, but the lack of that sort of like human element and that human compassion is a weakness in this movie, I would say. But no, yeah, I mean, like, it's, I think it's really helpful to get that background and your perspective on the novel, because at least for Neumeier and Verhoeven, they kind of struggled at least at first to like approach the themes, or what they saw as the themes of militarism and fascism in the original novel. Like, how can they kind of comment on that without recreating it was sort of their challenge. So Neumeier said that he wanted to mess with the audience. Like, that was verbatim what he said he wanted to do. He said that he wanted to show a utopia, like a future society that actually works, that just happens to be a military dictatorship, which I think is an interesting sort of contrast or tension there. And Verhoeven wanted to do a similar thing. He wanted to kind of subvert those themes even more than Neumeier wanted to. You know, he wanted the audience to look at these characters and say, are these people crazy? Like, why are they behaving this way? So both of them, the screenwriter and the director, you know, stated up front that they basically wanted to like screw with the audience a little bit. And I think we feel that in the finished product, you know?
Yeah, it's, I think it is a little at odds with itself, with presentation and intended presentation. But damn it, maybe that's the point.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly unique. And it's like, I don't know, these feelings of like disorientation and bafflement that we feel is certainly intentional, you know, and hopefully like urges us to like reflect on the experience and try to figure out what the movie's actually trying to say.
Yeah.
In any case, production accelerated by 1996. That's when shooting began. Still at TriStar, there was a lot of turnover for the producers there. So Verhoeven actually said that they did not have a lot of supervision from producers because people were being fired left and right. And he said that it was kind of like great creative freedom, although that they like they were worried that they were going to like lose their funding at any moment. But, you know, they were able to work pretty freely for that reason.
Jeez.
It was a really arduous, difficult shoot in Wyoming and South Dakota. There was extreme heat, windstorms, rain, and blizzards. Numerous cast and crew members suffer heat stroke, respiratory illness. Just a lot of kind of difficulties in the making of this movie. One kind of anecdote that I wanted to bring up real quick is the shooting of the co-ed shower scene, which I think has already kind of become like one of the more infamous scenes in this movie, where all the soldiers are showering naked together. Just a little trivia fact, the actors were a little bit reticent to take off their clothes and shoot that scene. So Verhoeven and cinematographer Joe Stefano also got naked, and they were the only two people on set at the time. I think the sound recorders too. So, you know, I think it's, there's an interesting story that Verhoeven said that he wanted to include that scene because these characters are so worried about war and like, you know, their careers and everything that they don't have any sexual attraction towards each other. Like, they don't have any libido whatsoever, and it's all about like power and war for them, which I mean is a sign of how carefully he thought through this movie, even if it seems kind of ridiculous when we're watching it, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that scene stands out.
For sure, yeah, yeah. I think it's kind of interesting. So the, you know, just another sign of the difficult production of this movie, there were sort of two different studios that were tasked with doing the special effects for the film. There's Tippett Studio, which we talked about Phil Tippett before, and his studio was doing the creature effects, the actual bugs. Sony Pictures Imageworks was supposed to do the spaceship effects, and Sony, like TriStar is a Sony company, so they actually demanded that they use SPI to do the spaceship effects for the film. However, SPI, according to some people that worked on the production, was very poorly managed, was behind schedule all the time, did subpar work. So they actually had to kind of shop out that work a little bit. Industrial Light and Magic stepped in to do some of the special effects work for the film. Yeah, I just think kind of that, you know, the turbulent production is kind of interesting in the context of this movie, which is so bizarre in the final product.
Yeah, and I did notice more than one effects company in the credits. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Certain scenes did undergo re-edits before this film was released. It includes a shortening of the brain-sucking scene and cutting a moment in which Carmen kisses Rico at the end. Preview audiences thought it was immoral that Carmen would kiss Rico so soon after her lover Xander dies and wanted Carmen to die at the end instead of Dizzy.
I think that's,
I love that, because
yeah.
I thought Carmen was such a wet blanket of a character.
She is, absolutely. I sort of feel like almost everybody in this movie is a wet blanket, you know? Like,
except Dizzy. I thought she was, yeah, I thought she was bringing something the others weren't.
Yeah, I agree. Like, there are some pretty cheesy romantic triangles in this movie, which are very hard to care about. But she brings kind of an emotional element to it, which I kind of suspect that maybe Verhoeven, like, didn't even want. Like, he didn't want this to be an emotional movie. But, you know, Dina Meyer, the actress who plays Dizzy, kind of makes that happen anyway, which is sort of great.
Yeah, her death is rough. I went, no.
Maybe Dizzy. The only likable character in the movie, yeah.
Yeah.
That's also a sign of just how, like, mean, like, audience preview comments can be, you know? Like, oh, we wanted this one to die instead. I think that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, the film did premiere well. It won the box office its opening weekend and became TriStar's third largest opening weekend ever. However, it did fall off in popularity quickly and only made a modest budget, thanks mostly to its success in overseas markets.
And when the movie first came out, it got mostly very negative reviews. The Washington Post, Roger Ebert, New York Times, all of them kind of said it was a ridiculous movie, which it certainly is. Some of them even said that it supported fascism instead of ridiculing it. And I, like, just knowing Verhoeven's body of work and, like, his past, like, his life history, I don't really know how you can make that argument. But in any case, this movie was pretty viciously criticized when it first came out.
Yep. I read all that stuff too.
Yeah. It should be said, however, that it's had very much, I mentioned this at the beginning of the episode, but it's really had a critical reappraisal since then. A lot of critics think it's one of the best American movies of the 90s. And according to some, a brilliant comment on, you know, the fascism and militarism of where the United States was heading in 1997 and arguably where we're at right now in 2023.
Yeah.
In any case, now is probably a good time for our sponsor break. Maybe a weird transition, but here we go. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
Woo!
Yeah. Ooh. Vincent, do we have anything from Mina's mailbox tonight?
we have something. I'm not going to read the person's name. This was on Instagram. I hope they're okay with me kind of sharing it, but I won't share their name. They just they did respectfully disagree with our critique of GMK, Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, Giant Monsters, All Out Attack. They love the movie, which, again, I think is fair. I think it's great. They cite the traditional violent reputation of Godzilla and how GMK does fall into that. Again, I don't disagree with that. Just for me, I feel like it didn't quite, it wasn't the same, reason for violence as other depictions of Godzilla I've seen, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I feel the same way. And I, you know, I think, you know, the sort of sinister, foreboding nature of Godzilla when he was first introduced, had kind of like that political kind of background to it. Whereas in GMK, it doesn't seem to have that much, you know, depth or motivation to it. But also, you know, that's a beloved movie. I was surprised to find that out when we did the GMK episode. So I know we're kind of in the minority on that.
Yeah, we'll own that.
Yep. Absolutely, yeah.
But hey, you listening out there, thank you for sharing your thoughts. That's what we love to do, talk about monster movies. So other folks listening can do so at campkaiju@gmail.com or find us on Instagram or campkaijumoviereviews.com.
Indeed. Always love to hear dissenting opinions, so please send them in if you have them.
Yeah, doesn't happen enough. I want more dissension.
Yeah, exactly. That seems appropriate for the conversation we're currently having.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've been kind of talking your ear off a little bit. Do you want to talk about any of the, like, I know we've mentioned the themes in this movie already a little bit, but, like, in more detail, do you want to talk about anything?
Yeah, we could talk about the themes. I mean, that's like the bread and butter of this movie when people talk about it and they critique it. Militarism, fascism. I did see lots of themes, maybe more overtly, not more overtly, but maybe more resonant, doesn't matter, colonialism, specific elements. Then specifically with like the fascism, there are elements in the design of this movie that hark back to Nazi emblems and architecture and cinema. You had mentioned that propaganda film, what was that called again?
Triumph of the Will.
Triumph of the Will, right. So we have eagle insignias, things like that. Verhoeven said the film reflected aspects of modern American life, like lack of gun control and the rise of capital punishment in Texas under then Governor George W. Bush. He described the characters as, quote, fascists who don't know they're fascists. Also football and Fox News. I don't quite get that.
I threw those in there. I like the like arena football scene in this movie, oh, which is like a great like dig at football, you know, like,
yeah.
It's no surprise that everybody's so violent if we love a sport like that, you know?
Yeah.
I like that situation. Yeah.
And like the execution that's going to be televised live, yes, at 6 p.m. I thought that was great. That's, you know, those are great. To me, those were clear enough criticisms of our real world. Whereas it's just like, generally speaking, I didn't really like, okay, the themes are there, but for me, they weren't as deep as I thought they were going to be.
Yeah, I mostly agree. I think it works the best when they are a little bit more pointed and specific, like you said. You know, I put the Fox News thing in there because there's that scene where it's sort of like a debate show, like a talking points show that you would see all the time on Fox News, where this there's like a female pundit on the show who's like, you know, bugs have intelligence. They're thinking, feeling creatures. And this guy, this very pedantic guy, is like, just like totally scoffs and rolls his eyes. And he's like, I'm offended you would even suggest that. Mm-hmm. Like that is like almost exactly like a show you would see on Fox News nowadays.
Yeah.
So I like the, you know, the kind of satirical element there, which seems like it has a very specific target.
Yeah. And the soldiers giving away bullets to all the kids.
Yes.
That was great. That's like those moments I really latched on to as pointed critiques.
Yeah. And almost all of those are in like the fake propaganda ads, which are like kind of littered throughout the movie, you know?
Yeah.
And those, in my opinion, are like by far the best part of this movie.
Agreed. They're really fun. Something you don't see every day.
Fun and also kind of angry at the same time, you know? Like there's a very, very much like a critique buried, maybe not buried, it's pretty overt, but like certainly, you know, on the surface there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, funny and darkly comic for sure. You know, we've already talked a little bit about some of the pro-violence stuff. Like the movie kind of recycles what, you know, the makers think is, you know, one of the themes of Robert Heinlein's novel, which is this pro-violence theme, like violence can solve everything, is kind of the satirical point of the movie. You know, there's a line from Ratchik? I already forgot how you pronounce
Ratchak.
It. Ratchak. He says, violence has resolved more conflicts than anything else. The contrary opinion that violence doesn't solve anything is merely wishful thinking at its worst. So that's definitely one of the main satirical points of the film as well.
Yeah, one thing I liked that you noted, the idea that citizenship is tied to military service in this movie and the book, I find really interesting. And obviously that, you know, would be very fascist and nationalistic way of thinking, your rights are entirely tied up to your capacity for violence, right?
Yeah.
In favor of, in interest of the state. But there's a female character in the movie who says, I joined because I want to have children. And I was like, whoa, that blew my mind. That was a great moment too. A great moment in like, you know, critiquing the state.
Yeah, definitely. I was struck by that line as well. And there's also like one very quick throwaway line where somebody says that humans encroached on the bugs' territory first. And that's why they're like attacking us. It's basically self-defense and they're trying to defend their own land. That's kind of like a blink and, well, not blinking, you'll miss it, but like, you know, if you're not paying attention, that line can like really pass you by. But I think that's one of the few lines in the movie that makes it clear that like these soldiers who are maybe supposedly the heroes of the movie really are the villains. Like we are the instigators and we should not be cheering on these characters who we're watching for more than 2 hours, you know?
Yeah.
I guess with all these themes and kind of how it connects to American society and culture after the movie came out, for example, after 9/11, the fact that with the Patriot Act, a lot of Americans were kind of willing to give away their rights in order to kind of like strengthen our boundaries and protect ourselves from this sort of vague threat. Like at first it was a very specific threat, and then it's kind of just like, oh, let's start a war because we think they're somewhere over there, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that element. And then of course the rise of neo-fascism that kind of accompanied Trump's presidency and is still very much with us in American society. You know, this movie's defenders would say that this was a very prescient movie in kind of predicting some of the strains of politics and social behavior that have become even more noticeable in American life since then.
I agree. I think this movie is complicated. It's not complicated for me. It's complicated for me to wrap my head around the defenders of the movie. And like, I was watching some behind the scenes featurettes of this film, and the producer, Phil Davison, so many other people behind the creative team, like, are defending this movie and being like, no, this is what Verhoeven meant. This is what he meant. And for me watching it, I'm like, if that's what he meant, which I will believe he meant that, I think he just missed the mark. I do think, like, I don't think it, if it's supposed to be a subversion of these, of a fascist state, I don't think he goes nearly far enough to do that. I think I am only responding to what I see, and I see a utopia. I see beautiful people who aren't really doing anything bad or vile. I don't see them persecuting Jews. I don't see them persecuting human beings. I see them persecuting vicious, violent bugs who I would not want to be near. So like, there was like a real, like, I couldn't get into hating these characters. I didn't love them because they were boring, but that's its own critique. But I wasn't like, oh yeah, these humans are bad. I'm like, no, they're doing what I would do, I guess.
Yeah, I agree with both kind of sides of that argument. You know, like, I do see what Verhoeven is trying to do, and I think it's a very clever, intelligent, again, subversive, to use that word again. I think it's all those things. But at the same time, well, also I'll just add that I think, you know, of course the bugs are supposed to be a metaphor, kind of like, if we see a bug being trapped in a cage and these soldiers just like brutally shooting it over and over again, we don't really mind all that much. But if it was like a political prisoner, that, like, it would be very, very different, obviously. So
right.
Yeah, so I see what it's trying to do there, but I also agree with you that, like, that commentary is not deep or pointed enough to really sort of, first of all, like, warrant the very, like, cold and vicious tone of this movie. And I'll talk about that a little bit more soon. But also, it's just not the masterpiece that people think it is. And I think this happens sometimes where, like, a movie comes out and it gets bad reviews, and then some critics, maybe like 10 or 20 years later, are like, no, you misunderstood it. It's a masterpiece. And it's like, well, it's probably in between, right? Like, maybe it's not as bad as you originally thought, but it's also not one of the best movies ever made. So let's, like, temper our enthusiasm a little bit.
Yeah.
That's the way that I think.
No, yeah. It's difficult to explain it, which I maybe is a strength of the movie. It's difficult to parse this out.
Yeah.
And to say exactly what you're thinking. When Neil Patrick Harris shows up at the end wearing a black trench coaty uniform reminiscent of like the Gestapo or something, I mean, I'm like, yeah, obviously this is a Nazi callback, but like, just putting a Nazi emblem on the screen doesn't subvert it, doesn't critique it. You know, does that make sense?
It does, yeah, and I agree with you for sure. I think there are sporadic moments where the commentary is like a little bit more specific and more successful.
Yeah, but
yeah, when it's just kind of like recycling this Nazi iconography, it's trying to be provocative for not a very substantial reason, you know?
Yeah. All right.
And I would, yeah.
No, sorry.
No, that's. I mean, I think Verhoeven does that a lot. Like movies like Elle and Black Book are two that come to mind. Benedetta, his more recent movie, where he's really trying to like provoke and anger the audience. And sometimes there's not a lot of reason behind that, you know?
Mm.
What about the form and the aesthetic of this movie? Anything you want to talk about there?
I love all the action set pieces. That's the blend of the special effects, practical and computer generated. I love that it's shot on location instead of like a sound studio or something.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell it's like, you can feel the grit of the sand and the, you know, the bad land looking topography. I this is just a lot of critiques that I'll swing back to, but like the teenage vibe, it's a very young movie, which we talked about in the casting, but it also plays as like, oh, this is a movie for teenagers in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
Which I don't relate to. I mean, obviously relate to going to prom, but like, I don't know. There's a tone there that maybe it's not what I was expecting, especially after reading the book, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like the kind of sappy love triangles, and there are sort of two love triangles between who is it? Carmen, Rico, Xander, Dizzy. There's a lot going on there. And like that was not part of the original book and does not really seem to like tie into like the political points that the movie's trying to get across. So I don't know why that's such a big feature throughout the film. Like it's not very interesting. And I don't really, aside from maybe being like intentionally kind of like goofy, I don't really know why that's such a major part of this movie. It's strange.
Yeah, maybe just because it's like, you know, we talked about this with Tremors. There is no apparent love story or triangle between Val, Earl, and Rhonda. But Neumeier, I mean, and I respect Neumeier a lot, but he clearly was like, this version needs love interests. I'm like, okay, that's fine. It just, I didn't buy it in this particular movie.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah, and you know, like he and Verhoeven, especially Verhoeven, have said stuff like, yeah, well, like you're not supposed to like the characters and like they're all kind of rotten people. And like they kind of use that as an excuse, Verhoeven does anyway, for like, you're not really supposed to care about the love triangles. And it's like, well, but okay, why do you have them then? Like, that's kind of like the empty provocation part of it to me, you know?
And the relationships, like Carmen, she is completely fair weather. Like she likes Rico, but then she's really into Xander. And it's just so angsty, and I don't believe anyone's feelings, which maybe was the point, but again, why are we devoting so much time to this?
Yeah, exactly. I think like red at its most generous level, it could be like an indication of how none of these people have any kind of like emotional substance at all. Like it's all just about like whatever connections and relationships can like give them power and like help them advance and kind of secure themselves. I think maybe, you know, that's what the movie's trying to get across, but it doesn't really matter if you don't care about the relationships. Like, I don't know. It's, if that's what it's trying to say, it's not very successful at it.
Comparing it to the book, unfairly or not, there's a deeper relationship between Rico and his parents. So when Buenos Aires is wiped off the map, his mom is killed in that attack. His dad ends up surviving, but he doesn't know that at the time. And that's his impetus for, no, it's not his impetus for joining up, but it has a deeper emotional impact than it does in the movie.
I should try to finish the book at some point, but I'm not surprised to hear that it's more emotional than the movie, because the movie basically has like no emotional impact, you know? maybe intentionally, but who knows? Maybe that's just an excuse.
But RoboCop was so emotional. Like that, the character of RoboCop, I was like in his heart. It was so beautifully crafted, his relationships with his family and stuff.
Yeah. And also his more recent movie Black Book, which is I think set in the Netherlands. In any case, it's set in Europe during World War II, so I feel like it's trying a little bit more directly to like deal with his maybe deep-seated trauma or just like his childhood experiences. So I feel like that movie's a little bit more emotionally sincere as well.
Mm.
There was one more thing I wanted to mention about the aesthetic of this movie, which is that it's like, it doesn't really call attention to itself in terms of like the editing or the camera work or the music all that much. Like, it's fairly straightforward. It's kind of exactly what you would expect like a giant bug movie to be. So I just think it's kind of interesting that the themes, hypothetically, debatably, are like so complex and so there's so much to them, but then the visual style is like relatively straightforward. I could have used a little bit more like visual innovation here, you know?
True.
The special effects do look good though. I agree with you there.
Right. And that's, I guess, what I mean, that's what I want out of this movie. That's what I love about this movie. I wanted more, I guess, but there's a lot already. There's a lot of battles in this movie, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, but I do think they get mind-numbing after a while. Like, as much as I like the special effects, you can only watch somebody shooting a bug with a machine gun for so long, and then it's like the same thing over and over again. So
that's true.
And that was a critique that I think a lot of reviewers mentioned when this movie first came out, and that I would agree with as a criticism. If you don't have anything else for the form and aesthetic section, I think we can move on to the good, the bad, and the campy.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Cool. There's obviously so much to this movie, so much to talk about. I feel like we've, or maybe there's not as much to talk about as meets the eye. It could be somewhere in between. So, yeah, we'll wrap some of this up in this last section here. So, is there anything else in the good that you want to talk about?
The brain bug was so disgusting. I wanted to throw up, and that's a good thing. Like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that. And it's because it's a puppet. It just is that much grosser.
Yeah, and then like the puppet also of like Xander and his like desiccated face or whatever. It's so disgusting.
Oh my God, yeah. So it was appropriately gory throughout. Location, set design. Yeah. I did like the co-ed nature of this military, fascism aside. I was like, yeah, why can't we live in a world where men and women shower together?
Right. Yeah. Not that big of a deal. And like, you know, the fact that like the captain of the ship that Denise Richards is like the co-pilot of is like a woman and like a great pilot. And like, you know, I've read that the book, maybe, I don't know if you agree with this, but has some like sexism in it. But the movie, I think, is trying to like avoid that, I guess. It's like, I don't know. I don't know if we should really give it that much credit for that, but
well, the characters are still women, and in the book, the women are talked about as being their judgments are quicker, they're quicker to make decisions. That's why they pilot the starships, because they can get troopers in and out really quickly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So it's I think even in the book, my estimation is it's a pretty equal gender world.
Cool. Okay. That's good to hear. So the movie should not get too much credit for just, you know, translating that, I guess.
No.
Yeah, fair enough. For me, you know, like, I do think it's a very smart movie and it has political themes. It's trying to like talk about things that are actually going on in the United States in when this movie came out in the late 90s. So yeah, very clever, it's kind of like a very mischievous movie, you know, like you can tell that like the makers of it thought they were like really pulling a fast one on us, for better or worse. Really love the propaganda ads, like all the best parts of this movie, I think were those ads, which I, you know, point towards like, I kind of hate the phrase fake news. So I'll say like, they point towards how media depictions are like untrustworthy and like, it's all of it could be propaganda. It's not all propaganda, but it could be. I like all that subtext. I think it's really fascinating. And I think sometimes it's really funny. It has like a very over the top, very ridiculous tone. And again, mostly in those propaganda ads, I laughed out loud numerous times. Although sometimes I think we're laughing at the characters, which is not a great feeling. So I have to give the movie credit for all that.
Yeah. A couple of things that didn't work for me. So when Buenos Aires is attacked and they're watching that footage, I went, yeah, who wouldn't want to go to fight these bugs who just killed like 8 million people? But then I was watching the behind the scenes and they were talking about how the populace is, they only know what their government is showing them on TV. So then I was like, oh, did Buenos Aires actually get attacked? That's interesting. I wish it was clear. If that's what you intended, I needed it to be clearer. Otherwise, of course, I'm on the side of the humans in this war for, you know, this apocalyptic war we're fighting.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I read something interesting in relation to this movie, although it's like kind of a more recent thing called Poe's Law. This is a big thing in like social media now, where if somebody's writing something sarcastically or like subversively or like trying to like deconstruct something, but they don't make that super obvious, then of course it can just be construed as like genuinely meaning what it's trying to convey, you know? So if there's a post about fascism that's trying to make fun of it, but it doesn't make that clear, then you could think it's just another fascist social media post, you know? And I think that kind of is a problem in this movie. And it's like a thin line, because I don't want it to like sort of just spoon feed the themes to us. But also there needs to be, I think, some indication that, you know, just like what is the target of its satire and why does it matter? And we've already talked about it a little bit. Like sometimes I do think the movie is successful at that, but at other times it's just like too broad and it's like using these images and this iconography in kind of an empty way at times.
I can't say any better. That's really enlightening what you just talked about. But yeah, I agree with you on that. My other thing is, I know Verhoeven, he was going for the Nazi Hitler Youth look of this movie, but I couldn't get over the fact that this is literally set in a Latin American country and everyone is as white as a German person. And I'm like, I know it was a choice, but I don't agree with that choice. I can't get out of that choice, especially in 2023.
Yeah. Right. It's, yeah, I mean, like you said, I think it's intentional because, like, it's almost like the entire world has been, like, whitewashed by this point, even though that's not, it's not realistic. That's not what's happening, which is good, obviously. But, like, even if it's, like, an intentional satirical point, it's just, like, what's going on here?
Right. I can believe it's the 23rd century. Sure. At some point, maybe Hitler's idea of the Aryan race actually dominated the world. I would like to have seen that. I need that context because otherwise I don't like the names are Rico. The names are Carmen. It's like you're Ibanez, which is more specifically, you know, Latino, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A hang up for me I couldn't get past.
Yeah. No, that's definitely understandable. Yeah. I agree with all of your criticisms, and I would like, I alluded to this before, but I think this is a very cold and kind of nasty movie. I think Verhoeven's films are often anti-humanist. We're not really supposed to care about the characters very much. I kind of get the sense that Verhoeven is like standing above it all and kind of looking down on both the content in his movie and the audience themselves and sort of saying like, I'm smarter than you, see if you can pick up on these themes or whatever. That's a little bit harsh because I think he is a very smart, witty filmmaker, but like, and also I think it's kind of refreshing sometimes to have a movie that's not totally like sentimental and emotional and like tugging at your heartstrings and stuff like that. But this movie and some of Verhoeven's other films are just like very vicious and don't really care about their characters at all. So like, why should we care about them if he doesn't care about them, you know?
Yeah.
What do you got for the campy?
The first thing I immediately wrote down was there's a, after like the first battle on planet P, it's night and all the soldiers are relaxing. They're playing music and dancing, but like they're playing music and dancing like it's a Civil War era battle, you know, and the guy pulls out a fiddle and starts fiddling Dixie, actually, which was probably intentional. But yeah, it was just like, oh, this is very like 19th century all of a sudden. I love it.
Yeah. You know, a good way to kind of like bring in America's military history, even though the Civil War is like, I don't know, not as morally questionable as the other wars that America's been involved with. But yeah, that's a very clever moment for sure.
Yeah.
The campiest moment for me is pretty early on where like one of the teachers at the high school that they go to, I think it's their science teacher, is like this disfigured, like mad scientist looking person, a woman with like black glasses and like burn marks on her face, which I read after I watched the movie, it was played by Rue McClanahan of the Golden Girls fame.
Oh,
amazing. Right. She's unrecognizable in that makeup. I think it's kind of funny, kind of dark that like even their science teacher is like this, you know, grizzled, like war wounded vet or whatever.
Yeah, that was fun.
All right, so there's a lot of stuff going on here, a lot of good and a lot of bad for sure. So it's time for our ratings, as always, on Camp Kaiju. I will read them off as usual. Our top rating is, it's a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our last rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
All right.
I can go first if you want, and you can have the last word. I feel like I had the last word last time. So
did you?
Or you can go first if you prefer.
Whatever. I'll go first because I think you had the last word on Tremors.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think. I don't remember, man.
Either way.
I'll go first because this was your movie and you know. I think it has some antiquated moments, but I do think it stands the test of time nonetheless. I think the action is really good. I think the effects are really good. Where this movie shines is in its like those fake news reels where the critiques of our contemporary militaristic state work. And when it gets going, maybe like the second half of the movie, it's a ride. The first half doesn't work for me. The love stuff doesn't work. And the casting doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
But okay. Hey, I would watch it again. Yeah.
No, I love it. I'm actually somewhat shocked because it seemed throughout our conversation that I liked this movie maybe, or just like found it more interesting maybe, or something a little bit, but I'm going to give it a lower rating than you.
Whoa.
For me, I like it. Historically significant. I do think this movie has a lot going on politically, has a lot of ideas, but to me, it does not stand the test of time. This is, like I said, the fourth time I've seen this movie. And every time I'm like, yeah, it has those ideas, but they're not pointed enough. And like, really the main hindrance for me is that this movie has like a very, again, cold, vicious tone that I don't like. I guess I prefer humanist art that kind of like wants us to empathize with the characters and, you know, kind of empathize with the human experience a little bit in that way. I'm on the line. I'm straddled between this and like the higher rating, but like maybe I'm just trying to push back against the people that say like, oh, it's the greatest movie ever made. And like some people do kind of like over embellish that a little bit. But yeah, no, for me, like this movie doesn't totally work. And every time I'm like, it's not there for me. It doesn't do it for me. So to me, it does not stand the test of time.
All right. That was a wild card. I expected our verdicts to be flipped, honestly.
So did I. Yeah. But I love it. I mean, you know, an episode about Starship Troopers is keeping us guessing. It seems appropriate.
Because it does offer so much politics and theory and philosophy and humanism. And it's like, suddenly we are talking about like what does it mean to be pro soldier but not pro military, and like where are these lines that we draw for ourselves?
Yeah, totally. And I love all that. I love that the movie is able to kind of encourage those conversations, but to me this is a movie that's more fun to talk about and write about than to actually watch, you know.
Word. Let's leave it at that.
Thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Minya's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Thanks again for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time on Camp Kaiju.
Young people from all over the globe are joining up to fight for the future.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part.
I'm doing my part, too.
They're doing their part. Are you? Join the mobile infantry and save the world. Service guarantees citizenship.